You are listening to Spot On, a health and wellness podcast that breaks through the latest media headlines to provide you with accurate and usable information that is, well, spot on to meet your needs. I am your host, Dr. Joan Salgi-Blake, a nutrition professor at Boston University and the author of the college textbook called Nutrition and You, which is used in colleges across the United States and abroad. Today on Spot On, we're going to be talking about fighting cancer with a fork and a knife. Why we're doing this is because, you know, recently we've been hearing that cancer is occurring in younger and younger people. But I've got some very good news for you. And it's not all as scary as you think it is. So let's stay tuned and find out the latest about how to fight cancer with a knife and a fork. Okay, we're back here now with my special guest, and we're going to dig deep and figure this out. And I think, you know, people are frightened of the C word, but I have my special guest here is going to say, don't be as frightened as you used to be about that, because she might have some very, very good news. My guest today is Lauren Fay. She has a master's in public health. She's a registered dietitian and has a specialty in cancer and cancer prevention and treatment, you know, through dietary. And she works with a whole oncology team because she's the clinical nutrition manager. So she's the big coo-hoo over Shaw Cancer Center in Virginia. So that's why I'm having her on here, because she's seen it all, knows it all, and is on top of it all. So with that, Lauren, I can't thank you enough for coming on Spot On. So, you know, Lauren, we talked a little bit about this when I reached out to you, and, you know, Kate Middleton, she's 42, and you're hearing more and more about cancer among younger adults. But at the same time, Lauren, I'm hearing that, you know, the C word, as people call it, what we should do is change the name. Can we change the name and change it to something else? Because the word cancer is just not.
It has a PR problem for
sure. It has a PR problem. Hello, America PR companies. Can we get together and figure out?
We need a strong rebrand.
A strong rebrand, Lauren. I love it. A strong rebrand. So even though the C word, which is going to have a new name soon, is frightening, really, aren't many cancers now considered like a chronic disease, like, you know, heart disease and diabetes?
So it's a great question. And, you know, I will tell you, even leading up to this conversation, you know, you've posed some thought-provoking questions that have made me think a lot about my own perspective. Mm-hmm. Because as you mentioned, you know, my career has been dedicated to working with people most of the time after a diagnosis of this disease of cancer. And I think what we need to do a much better job of in the cancer community is really helping people understand the current state of cancer care. The advancements in screening techniques, treatment outcomes in this disease, in the relatively speaking short 15 years I have been working in this arena, is unbelievable. Diseases that had a essentially fatal diagnosis when I started are now going into remission with some of the advancements in therapies and screening techniques. So all, you know, I think we were being lighthearted, but in all seriousness, when people think of cancer, they're thinking about cancer in the 1950s and the 1960s. And that perception and interpretation and the fear that it induces is correct for that period of time. We are just so far beyond that. And I do want to take the next step to why this is such a dangerous misconception, is because when people have the impression and the fear that ultimately the diagnosis of this disease is not treatable and not survivable, we have tremendous amounts of data to show it limits their, you know, it causes anxiety that prevents them from going to the physicians and treatment facilities where it can be caught early, which we know then lessens the interventions needed to let them live healthy beyond that diagnosis. And so, I mean, this really is an important understanding that you know, cancer is not something we are ever going to be free of as organisms. It's an error in a replication cycle of a cell. But the earlier we catch it, we live beyond it with the least amount of consequences from treatment.
You know, that's so true, Lauren, because we all know, well, you know, grew up saying, everybody's going to have heart disease. If you live long enough, you're going to have heart disease. But that doesn't scare you. Like, if you live long enough, you're going to probably end up getting cancer. That doesn't scare you. So while heart disease, I can remember when you say the 1950s and 60s and 70s, don't look at me like I know those, you know, decades. All right, Lauren, so just stop right now. But, you know, when it, in that, when you somebody had a heart attack, oh, God. You know, like oh, you know. But now you had a heart attack. Okay, now, so what'd you do? Oh, I got bypass. Oh, you know, it's just like, it doesn't frighten you like this. And I can't wait to get more of this whole idea of a PR firm out there to say, this is really, really going to sort of being a chronic disease now. We're just going to keep on fixing it and maintaining it. And, you know, you maintain it and then they come out, maintain it and stay on top of it for 2-3 years. And then they come out with another good, you know, medicine or something else to do it. What I want to know is why all of a sudden are we hearing it more in young people? Is it because we have better, you know, screening? Like, what's going on here?
I'm going to give you the unsatisfying answer first, and then we're going to talk through the details.
Okay.
Short answer is we're not sure. Oh. And this is a question that is plaguing the cancer community, because what we are certain of is that data consistently over the past 30 years is showing increased rates for young adults, mm-hmm. as high as 80% higher in the 1990s, depending on which cancer types that you're looking at. And so the call to action now is why. We have a lot of very logical proposed mechanisms for this, which includes things like diet, lifestyle, and how that impacts our body composition. But ultimately, and you know this from many other forms of nutrition science, what we need to do is study and make sure that those relationships are causal, meaning that diet composition, body composition is something that's truly causing this, because otherwise we might be going after the wrong intervention to fix this problem. This is something that is we are going to have answers on. There's an international coalition of groups, including investigators from the National Cancer Institute, that over the next 5 years are going to be looking globally, because these rates are increasing globally in those young adults, to identify what are these factors and mechanisms that we do understand are causal. That the proposed mechanisms, many of them are related to modifiable risk factors, which have changed over the course of the past 3 decades, including diet, physical activity, sleep hygiene, which I think is optimistic in my opinion, in the sense of these are things that we can really move the needle on decreasing this rate from continuing to increase in this group. Right. I think to your question about screening, you know, one of the things that certainly with minute changes in ages recommended for certain screening procedures, including colonoscopies or mammograms, that could be one small explanation, but probably not the root cause. But the challenge here is when we see decreased rates in older adults, so for example, decreases in mortality related to colorectal cancer in individuals over 65, that's directly linked to screening and catching these diseases in early stages. A really important point to make for our listeners that are, you know, hearing this and are under that age of 50 is that we tend to not act or investigate symptoms that have changed in our body as quickly, and they're not being caught on typical screening technique exams. And so a lot of times these diseases are not only being found in younger individuals, which again, we're investigating the reasons as to why, but they're being found at more advanced stages, which has much worse prognosis. And so in terms of that call to action in this moment, you know, trying to make sure that any changes in things like, you know, noticing new lumps in areas of your body or changes in your bowel habits, you really need to seek out medical investigation to understand what's the cause of it.
You know, Lauren, that's so interesting because what happens oftentimes, you know, you in your 20s, you go to the doctor when you're sick. You don't do this typical yearly or, annual physical. You go when you're sick. And then what happens is, you know, for women, they go more often than men. And then if you, your females have babies, well, then you're with them for a while, you know what I mean? And then they kick on. But for a lot of males, you don't go until like, you know, maybe your mid-30s or, you know, yeah. And so you've lost all that time that you don't even, you know, have a doctor. And a lot of, now with like these clinics, you don't even have a doctor. You just, if you're sick, you go to a clinic, but there's no follow through. There's no Dr. Jones or whatever, doesn't follow you. And so it's interesting. And so the question is, do you think if we can catch them earlier, like the colorectal cancer, if we can catch it earlier, you think maybe screening will go down, the age for screening will go down? Colorectal, for example, is age 50 and above, right? You're recommended to get screened. Will it go down to 40 or 30 or, you know?
Potentially. And I think that these are really, really difficult decisions for the governing bodies that put out this type of guidance, right? Because, and I'll have to put on my public hat, health hat for a moment.
Don't put it on too long. Okay.
There are dangers to overscreening. Okay. It can lead to stress of false positive diagnoses or sometimes really invasive procedures that aren't necessarily required because screening is imperfect, right? That said, you know, this is the type of data we need to, again, understand why these rates are moving in this direction to better make those decisions that are best for population health. Okay. But it's a challenging question.
But, you know, we say you can pick your friends, but you can't pick your family. So if you have a history of this, grandma, grandpa, mom, dad, sisters, brothers, cousins, you know, if there's something going on in this family tree, there's a trend, then you should seek out, you know, medical support or guidance prior.
And every time we're talking about, you know, when we love to put things into numbers in terms of lifetime likelihood of developing cancer or, you know, risks based on a variety of things that are outside of our control, like you're describing, it doesn't apply to the individual. And you are absolutely correct that having that clear communication with family members about their health history can help you have more informed conversations with the primary care provider that now everybody's going to go out and make sure that they're visiting every year to decide, does this, you know, national screening guideline apply to me?
Hey, right.
Absolutely.
Because grandma and grandpa have this history. Excellent. You know, Lauren, that I teach here at Boston University and, with diabetes, you know, is out of control here in this country. And, I try to do things positive. I said, okay, well, about diabetes, what can't you control? Well, you can't control if you have type 1 diabetes. You have to take insulin, you know, whatever. But here's good news. Type 2 diabetes, look all the things that you can do to reduce your risk of getting type 2 diabetes. And I say, this is really empowering. You know, your diet and exercising and your body mass, but really more importantly is where fat is centralized in your body. So now, and people then say, oh, they're not afraid of diabetes now. So now I have to start teaching this about cancer. Like, I don't teach it. You know, I have to start saying this. Okay, so let's talk about cancer, and whatever the new term's going to be when we get the PR firm. And these are all the things, what you call modifiable risk factors, that you can do to lower the risk. And I'm going to start doing this the same way I teach diabetes. So let's get on to these. What are some things that we can do to lower your risk of getting cancer? Which, by the way, because I've seen this movie before, I know that these things you're going to tell me are going to be, oh, by the way, they also lower your risk of heart disease and type 2 diabetes. So, I have great time management skills. So if I'm going to eat a certain way and have a certain lifestyle, I want to be killing a lot of birds with one approach. So, can you tell us, you know, what these things you can do? What increases your risk of getting that C thing? And then what can you do to lower it through diet and lifestyle?
Absolutely. I think when we start talking about these modifiable risk factors, I always make an important point to describe what impact they have, because understanding this is really critical to our psychological approach to implementing these behaviors, which are absolutely risk reductive. And so when we put together the main categories of modifiable risk factors for cancer, which include diet, physical activity, tobacco use, alcohol consumption, and sun exposure, all five of those combined, we believe account for about 40% of cancers currently. Okay. And so that is significant. And to your point, and I agree with you, is a really positive and optimistic opportunity for us to reduce risk, right? That said, the other critical component to this conversation is understanding that that other 60% remains outside of our control, unfortunately. And so when we refer to that 60%, about 10% is genetics, so what we inherited from our family members. And that other 50%, in my opinion, is best categorized as bad luck. You know, this is a disease that at its root is an error in a replication cycle of a cell, and our cells are constantly replicating. So that error can happen for no reason at all. Why we need to be really appreciate that breakdown is that what we're going to discuss that is within our control to modify is something we should absolutely focus on to make best health choices that not only impact in reducing our risk for cancer, but optimize decreasing risk for cardiovascular disease, diabetes, you name it, right? But we also need to make sure we are not using this information as a source of stress, or thinking that by doing these things, it offers 100% protection. Because that we know from our behavioral health colleagues that when we use stress and fear to try to make behavior changes, it's not an effective motivator. Okay. Yeah. And so we do not have all of the answers as it relates to these modifiable risk factors, but we have more information than ever of where to put our efforts into risk reduction. Some of our most clear-cut, up-to-date guidelines that tell us about the nutrition factors that are able to reduce our risk for cancer come from the American Institute for Cancer Research and World Cancer Research Fund. These guidelines are rooted in 3 decades worth of history and have been revised 3 times, most recently in 2018. And I like to talk a little bit about how they were developed to understand the complexity of nutrition science as it relates to this complex disease. When these guidelines were initially constructed back in the mid-1990s. At that point in time, we had 2 to 3 decades worth of good quality data looking at the relationship between nutrition and cancer. But unfortunately, most of those studies were looking at one food and one nutrient and one cancer type, right? So lycopene and prostate cancer, beta carotene and lung cancer, red meat and colorectal cancer. This is all good science, but it didn't help anybody put together a plate of food for dinner. So what these scientists involved in both of these groups thought they need to do was pull together all the data they had and look for where there were patterns that they could translate into guidelines that clinicians like myself could use, as well as for public health goals worldwide. Mm-hmm. Obviously, research is growing and ongoing. So once again, these guidelines have been updated multiple times, most recently in 2018. And what they were able to do was identify 10 clear guidelines that can be risk reductive for cancer. And so we'll talk through the big ones in terms of most specifically and of highest interest to you and I is the nutrition components. And so the cornerstone of this guidance is what we call a plant-based diet. Now, speaking of PR problems, when you say plant-based at this moment in time, people interpret it very differently. Mm-hmm. So I want to clarify that when we're talking about these particular guidelines, we're talking about a diet pattern that is predominantly made up of plants. Fruits, vegetables, whole grain, carbohydrates, and beans. This does not mean you need to completely remove animal proteins from your diet. What we see is a diet that is at least 2/3 or the majority coming from a variety of those foods. You certainly would still get the benefits of plant-based diet eating if you do remove all animal proteins. It's just not something that we see further protective in terms of reduction of risk for cancer with that complete removal.
Lauren, I just want to comment on something you said, because that's really, really important, because a lot of cultures grew up with meat. And you can't, this is your culture, and this is what you enjoy. So don't have a guilt over this. You know, I'm saying this is, it's not bad. What we're going to say is that I like to call it plant forward rather than plant based, for plant forward, that the if two, or should say three quarters of your plate is all fruits, vegetables, and whole grains, then what's left over is maybe like a meat, fish, chicken. But look, just visually look at how small that part is on that plate. So what we can say is if you grew up with, you know, any kind of meat or whatever, it can be on there, but let's not, you know, make it, you know, half of the plate. And I have to tell you, growing up in New Jersey as an Italian, when we had steak for dinner, and we didn't have it like every night, but yeah. You got your own steak. I mean, yeah, you got your own steak. Like if there was four people at the table, you each, you made four steaks. I mean, you had your own steak. It's like a pet. So I you know, so in other words, you don't need to have your own steak.
But to your point, you also don't need to completely remove the entire thing. And that's, you know, that what we suffer from so much in nutrition, you know, communication is really battling against all or nothing thinking. And what matters is the proportions and what you're doing most of the time. And you know what I really like about the direction of the science, you know, not just specific to oncology, but is the hyper focus on it is much more important what you are including and being exposed to versus what you're removing, right? And so, you know, the direction of a lot of the literature when we're talking about poor dietary quality habits impacting our health, it really seems like it's not the, you know, ultra processed and certain foods that are bringing, you know, unhealthy components to our diet that are in and of themselves harmful. It's because they're also displacing exposure to the fiber and the phytochemicals when they are making up the predominant portion of the diet. So I think thinking about it in that term helps you better prepare your plate. And the plate model is something that we use all of the time here in our specialty. The American Institute for Cancer Research calls it the new American plate. And this is a tool you and I know can be utilized much easier than asking people to track servings per day of what they're consuming, exact volume. You can always look down and identify if your plate is mostly being made up of plants, whether you're preparing a meal at home for yourself or you're at a fast casual restaurant or out to Thanksgiving dinner or a barbecue. That's something you can visually always make a determination of, and it's really critical in terms of the diet pattern we see to be most risk reductive for this disease.
We are going to put a picture of this beautiful plate up on the Spot On Facebook page so you can get a, you know, visualization of it, because you eat with your eyes, Lauren, you know what I mean? So you look down your plate, does it look similar to this plate that is going to be healthy for you? And if you can just move things around on the plate, you'll get ahead of the game. So let's talk about some of these dietary components that should add. And I love what you're saying is, let's not focus on what you should reduce. Let's focus on what you need to add. And oh, by the way, they will crowd out the things that you are going to want to reduce. So it's not that you're really reducing them, they're just crowding them out. So think of it that way. So why don't we start?
Yeah. And so I think, you know, the next guidance talks about those things that you don't want to crowd out. Right. That predominantly plant-based meal. And so I'm going to say a very simple term for one of these guidelines that I want to unpack a little bit in terms of how we you know, really interpret it. So one of the guidelines includes limiting consumption of processed foods. Mm-hmm. And you and I both know that term processed is something that we are actually still working on as a scientific community to agree upon different levels of processing. But ultimately, once again, as a take-home message and how we implement and understand this now, it's foods that have had beneficial components removed, non-beneficial added. Right. So when we talk about one of the key benefits of plants, it's their fiber component. When we are removing fiber, you know, taking a whole grain, creating a white processed flour through that fiber removal, and then adding non-beneficial fat and sugar and deep frying it into a donut, we can understand that that's a processed food, right? Mm-hmm. It lacks the benefits of exposing us to fiber, which the plants incorporate that fill us up and keep us full for less calories, which helps optimize our body composition. And then ultimately adds extra calories that can be negative in terms of, you know, not filling us up for nutritionally deplete, you know, food. So I think that's a really important term to kind of think and understand once again, because people interpret it differently. The other really important term here is once again, limit. You know, you'll notice that this guidance doesn't say never can you ever again in your life have a processed food. What it means is you do not want these foods making up the majority of your meals, the majority of the days of the week, right? So it's not your slice of birthday cake that offsets your health risk or your occasional serving of French fries. It's when those foods are a regular part of your diet at each meal that it becomes problematic.
You know, we're talking, there's a difference between canned beans. You know, and there's nothing wrong. They're ready to open them up. You're ready to use those babies, high in fiber, higher in nutrients. The process of what the heck, you can get them on the table on a Tuesday night without having to soak them the night before and make a whole part-time job. So that's canned beans compared to jelly beans. We would have jelly beans, you know, on Easter. But now we eat jelly beans all year round. See, that's the problem. That's a big problem here. And you know, so what happens on holidays and your birthday, who the heck cares? And on Thanksgiving, enjoy, you know, and Hanukkah and Christmas, if there's candy in those stockings, go for it. You know, on Hanukkah, you got those chocolate coins. Oh, I love those. You know what I mean? Who cares? But every day is not Hanukkah, you know? And so I think that's what we have to go back to. So again, that plant forward plate, 3/4 of the plate. I love this. Let's add it. Let's add it and it'll crowd out. Okay, what else?
So something that I think is tremendously low-hanging fruit is talking about beverages.
Yeah.
And so we all, you know, part of our guidance within these guidelines is limiting consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages. Mm-hmm. And I think when I say this in 2024, I sometimes get eye rolls that, yes, we know soda's not good for us. But I always like to point out that there's an ever-growing market of other forms of sugar-containing beverages, some of which that are marketed as if they're healthier alternatives to things like water and unsweetened teas or coffees. So this is things like kombuchas with added sugar, cold pressed juices, energy drinks, sports drinks. The key here is these drinks are adding empty calories to our diet, which ultimately can negatively impact our body composition. It will eventually lead to weight gain from adipose tissue or fat, which we know is something that is a significant risk factor for at least 13 different cancer types. This is something that replacing these sugar-containing beverages with beverages that are not, so whether it be water by itself or even water that you've added things like citrus or herbs to give it a little bit of a hint of flavor, or unsweetened teas or coffee, is really where you want to be getting the majority of your hydration. And so this is something that I think, unfortunately, you know, with the promotional techniques to many different age groups, that we've been misled about the harms of these beverages, but something that's really easy to swap and, you know, maintain in terms of a risk reductive factor for cancer.
You know, that's so interesting. You just said that about these sweetened drinks, especially for certain age groups. So I do this educational thing in my class, and Boston University is 1.55 miles long. And we start at one end, and I visually say, let's start counting the coffee shops along this 1.5 mile radius. And so we're in double digits. Okay. So anyway, and the problem is coffee, but now we have these muka muka laka laka drinks to which they're drinking all day long, hot. And then when the weather changes, we go to cool maka laka lukas. And these sugary beverages are an everyday event. They're not just your birthday or Christmas or Hanukkah. They're an everyday event. And I truly believe there's something to that. We know with type 2 diabetes, we know now with heart disease, all this sweetened beverages are playing a problem. And you know, this generation has grown up drinking these like it's water.
Right. I mean, I'm a child of the 90s and was handed Gatorades at every sports game I played.
And you're right. These little kids are playing soccer and they're sitting on the bench drinking Gatorade. And they go out and they fairly go out and they play 12 minutes and they're drinking Gatorade. So, you know, it's like, you're right. We have done this. All right. So what else do we have to talk about?
All right. So before we leave beverages, we have to talk about alcohol. Okay. And so at this point in time, you know, we don't have a clear threshold for a safe level of consumption of alcohol that doesn't have a negative impact on cancer. So doing our best to try to avoid consumption is what we advise within the cancer community. Mm-hmm. I think that the authors of these guidelines acknowledge that not everyone is going to avoid alcohol completely. So to your excellent point earlier, we're taking into account the health of, every health outcome, not simply cancer. And so they do suggest that if alcohol is consumed, that we would defer to potential cardiac benefits that are seen with moderate alcohol consumption, which is one serving a day for women of all alcohol types, not just red wine, and two for men. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, it is something, though, that we need to understand that, you know, in terms of impact on cancer, that we just don't have that same threshold. I think culturally, one of the ways to think about ways to still be social and enjoy times that alcohol is normally present, I'm actually quite encouraged by this kind of push or increase interest in mocktails. Yes. And different ways to have fun drinks that, you know, you're in a social setting, whether it be, you know, a summer, again, summer barbecue or holiday party, and ways to still enjoy the company and social atmosphere that doesn't need to come with alcohol consumption. So I'm, again, finding ways to have that fun and enjoyment is really critical, but trying to minimize consumption of these beverages is advised.
You know, Lauren, you're correct. And this whole, Gen Z, these younger, they like this mocktail. And they'll tell me they don't want to wake up with a hangover, but they want to be with other people. They've been in COVID for 3 years and they just want to be with, they want to just have a good time. But at the same time, Lauren, I am seeing on, on Boston University and any campuses or cities, all of these new kind of mixed drinks in a can. We've got vodka and something else, and we've got, you know, and Tropicana now has it with alcohol. Like while we have these sober, curious people, you know, which is a wonder movement, I should say, I'm seeing more of these mixed drinks in cans that you could take to the beach. You could, you know, so what's going on with that?
I mean, I think that the goal of those companies is to make a profit, right? So they're trying to take on increased interest in variety of these beverages. And ironically, at times are really recreating existing offerings, just rebranded and trying to, again, get people to choose something that they associate with an alcoholic beverage. So for example, I mean, I started laughing the other day in the store when I saw a zero proof or alcohol-free seltzer from a company that makes hard seltzers. And I was like, those have existed for forever, you know? So I think trying to, if we think about both of those
I'm just wrapping my head around.
Yeah, I know.
So they have an alcohol-infused seltzer. And next to it is
the zero proof. Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't that called sparkling water?
Correct. So maybe they're who we need to call about our rebrand, because that's a really powerful rebrand and getting people to buy it. But I think ultimately, you know, when people are trying to make decisions for themselves about how to hydrate, being aware of both of those guidelines as it relates to hydration, that we're both aiming to minimize consumption of the alcohol itself, which is the problematic factor when we're talking about studying alcohol. It's the ethanol component of the beverage, right? But in addition to that, we don't want to therefore then substitute back to a sugar-containing beverage in lieu of that. And so I think thinking about both of those when you think about you know, fun drinks with, you know, fruits and umbrellas and all those types of things. There are many different ways that you can flavor that old school seltzer, you know, with fresh herbs and fruits. And there's a tremendous amount of recipe ideas on the American Institute for Cancer Research if people are looking for inspiring ways to create some of these beverages that are both low in sugar and alcohol free, that I would encourage people to check out and save a few bucks. You know, your college kids, you can't afford these drinks anyway.
And, you know, we'll put a link to that page on the spot on a Facebook page, so you can come up with fun little mocktails for you. All right, what else do you have for me, my dear?
All right, so let's talk about animal proteins.
Okay.
And so, you know, one of the things that I always want to point out when we're talking about these most up-to-date clear-cut guidelines is that you'll notice that not every single solitary food and nutrient is addressed within the guidelines. And it's not because they weren't just as well studied as the things that are addressed. It means we've studied them. And in terms of their impact on cancer, it's essentially net neutral, meaning we don't see that it increases risk for cancer or decreases risk. Most animal proteins fall into this category. So when we think about things like poultry, fish, mm-hmm. dairy, and eggs, they don't appear cancer protective, nor do they appear to harm us. So when we're thinking back to our plate model, that other one third of your plate that's not coming from plants, you can continue to balance it out with these animal proteins. The one animal protein we do see increased risk at high levels of consumption is red meat. Mm-hmm. And then I always like to point out with this guideline that despite an aggressive ad campaign in the 90s, that this does include beef, lamb, and pork when we talk about it in the scientific literature. And once again, this does not mean you need to completely exclude it. It means that when we see consumption over 18 ounces a week, which putting that into perspective, you know, palm of your hands, about 4 ounces, about 4 servings a week, seems to increase our risk for multiple cancers, but most predominantly our lower GI cancers and colorectal cancers. Mm-hmm. So trying to switch up your protein sources, if you are continuing to include those animal proteins, is a great idea to stay under that threshold.
Right, so what I was just going to say is, here we go back to, if you want a nice petite filet mignon, or, you know, a nice little, you know, beef on every Thursday, go ahead and have it. What's the big deal? But let's mix it up for the rest of the week. So we're going back to, you don't have a whole steak 3 times a week for dinner.
That's making up half of your plate.
Right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Exactly.
That's right.
Exactly. And then a kind of a subcategory of this particular guideline, which once again, I would personally consider kind of low-hanging fruit in terms of making small changes that make a big impact, is limiting the consumption of processed meat. So when we refer to processed meat in the world of cancer, we're referring to meats that have been salted, cured, chemically preserved, smoked, in an effort to preserve them, right? Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, and we don't really understand all the mechanisms as to why, when these additives are put in meat specifically, it seems to increase our risk once again for GI cancers, mostly of the lower GI tract, mm-hmm. Which is an interesting point, you know, in terms of many of the things that we're using to preserve these meats are not harmful to us in many other foods. So when you think of things like salt or nitrates mm-hmm. that we consume in other areas of our diet, or even things like nitrates being naturally occurring in many plants, mm-hmm. they are not harmful to us in that form. But for whatever reason, this combination of the animal protein meat with these factors are something that do have a negative impact. So trying to find substitutes, for example, rather than using deli meat in your sandwich every day, trying to use sliced chicken breast, tuna salad, a portobello mushroom, a black bean burger, switching up that opportunity doesn't mean you don't, you know, can never have sandwiches again. It means we just want to find something different to fill the middle of the bread. And similarly, other places that we see this is, you know, breakfast proteins like bacon and sausage. So trying to find other savory options that you can incorporate into that meal, whether it be things like, you know, a quiche, or, you know, certainly, you know, adding in a variety of vegetables to a frittata, for example, would be a good option. And then ultimately, and I know that you're very close to Fenway Park, where you guys are in Boston University, but trying to limit those Fenway Franks to, you know, only a few times a year would be a good idea, not having them on a regular basis. And so once again, this is not that you can never have any of these foods. It just, you don't want them making up a regular part of your meals on a regular basis. It really is those special occasions.
You know, I have to tell you something interesting. You know, this college generation didn't really, they don't really dig sandwiches. They're into bowls.
What?
Everything's in a bowl. Ask to be in a bowl, and it's all, like, it's like the plate in a bowl. Everything's in a bowl now. So, like, sandwiches, like, you know, but in a bowl, they're, like, right online. Right, what else do we got for me here?
So, another important one that we're going to deviate just for a moment from the nutrition components, but is in regards to physical movement. You know, balancing what we're eating with how we move is really critical to maintaining a healthy body composition, which once again, a critical component to risk reduction for cancer, in addition to cardiovascular disease, diabetes. And where we see the threshold for having an impact on cancer with moderate physical activity, which includes things like brisk walking, is 30 minutes 5 days a week. Or 150 minutes per week. One of the important points to this particular guideline that I do like to point out is that, you know, I think a lot of times people are often under the impression that we need to be triathlon training in order to be getting benefits from physical activity. But this is a threshold that is pretty comparable to risk reduction with physical activity for many other disease types. So trying to ensure that you're getting that level of movement at a minimum every day is, once again, one, you know, part of this totality of risk reduction that many that we should really be shooting for.
Then this is a problem because we have technology, and technology in this case is not our friend. And you know, we could be on screen time. I think last I read, young people are on it like over 10 hours a day. It's so unbelievable. And we can binge watch Netflix. We can, you know, there's a printer in every office. You don't have to walk to get to the main printer. Now there's home offices. So technology in this case isn't our friend. So we have to remember to move. And do, you know, I just got off a plane from L.A. And so, you know, I went to L.A. and I get off and now this is from Boston. So I'm sitting over 6 hours. I get out to the LAX and yeah, I'm walking to my terminal or whatever. And what do I see is people are on that moving walkway.
Yeah.
Now I'm saying to myself, you just sat
the flat escalator.
You just sat for 6 hours. Could you possibly walk to get your baggage? I mean, seriously. And that's the problem, where technology around us makes things appear to be very efficient. But we have to remember that maybe we shouldn't use technology all the time.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we talk about and historically have studied physical movement and its impact on health. And what we're studying in a you know, more higher focus now because of those changes is sedentary time, you know, and where we want to limit that, which is really challenging increasingly with, yeah, not just the technology referring to there, but, you know, the amount that we're attached to screens and our phones and all of these things that limit that physical activity.
All right, what else do we have to tackle?
Yeah, so this one might actually be a little bit of a surprise, but it's a really important point that, you know, within these guidelines, we actually have direct commentary on nutrition supplements. And so when we're talking about that, we're referring to concentrated vitamins, minerals, herbal supplements. And so the current guidance within these guidelines is, in the absence of deficiency, we do not recommend any supplements for prevention of cancer, during cancer treatment, or in recovery and survivorship, reducing your risk for recurrence. And this is because, counter to a common cultural misconception that some is good and more is better, or if more is not better, at least it's not harmful. Unfortunately, we have tremendous evidence in this arena with really well-intentioned and really well-done clinical trials that were trying to show benefit that showed us the complete opposite. Mm-hmm. We saw this as far back as the mid-1980s when a really well-done trial utilizing beta-carotene and vitamin E in an effort to reduce risk for lung cancer in 30,000 participants, double-blind placebo-controlled, showed us the exact opposite, and participants that received beta-carotene had a statistically significant higher incidence of lung cancer. Similarly, in prostate cancer, we had another very well-powered trial with 35,000 participants utilizing selenium and vitamin E with the hope of protecting against the onset of and progression of prostate cancer, that showed us 3 years after the trial was ended early for futility that the gentlemen that were getting vitamin E had statistically significant higher incidences of prostate cancer. Recently in breast cancer, retrospective review of a prospective group of women who reported supplement use had lower response rates to their chemotherapy and worse long-term outcomes when they self-reported any amount of supplements, mainly antioxidant containing, but it was really across the board. And so what this means to me as someone who has dedicated her life to food is that we are very much, you know, kind of oversimplifying the equation and being a little arrogant when we think that we can extract one individual component from food, concentrate it, take it in a pill or a powder, and get a superior benefit to the synergy that happens when we're consuming it in those whole food sources. So it's very clear at this point in time, especially as it relates to this disease, that the best way to get these nutrients is from your food, which you do by consuming a diet pattern that we spoke about. And, you know, the opposite is not true at this point in time. We need to continue to investigate any ways that we can utilize these nutrients. But at this, you know, it is clear right now that the safest place to get these nutrients is from our food.
It's the entire package. Mm-hmm. It's really the entire package that goes there. Anything else we haven't hit upon?
I don't think so. I think I just would like to reiterate, when we learn about this information and these risk reductive techniques, that once again, we are thinking about them as things that we can do in a positive fashion to reduce our risk and should never be used as a source of stress, and most certainly should never be used as a retrospective analysis on every decision we've made in life to this point. Because when it comes to this disease specifically, you know, which is true, you know, perhaps in different proportions, but of any other disease, is that it's complicated, and there's more things that are outside of our control that are influencing it. But viewing these in a, you know, positive way to make changes that you have control over, I think, is a really good motivating factor to make those choices.
And what I want to reiterate, that the C word also means chronic, so that it's chronic now, that it's being treated like a chronic disease, like heart disease and diabetes, just as like you said, through proper screening, getting things done early, catching things. Many can be, you know, chronically managed, and people are living with cancer for a very, very long time. And that's the good news.
Yeah, or even better, beyond cancer, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
So what you're saying now, someone else is going to get them, right?
Yeah.
Right. Thank you for putting this positive swing on this. And I think what most we started to say is, you know, if you see issues occurring, you know, things changing in your body, bowel habits or pains or, you know, lumps and bumps and whatever, to go talk to a physician. A person that's going to be with you forever, knows you, and keep this person, you know, in your pocket here, and let's stay on top of it, and don't be afraid, go, because this way, if you find something, it's treatable or manageable. So I think that's very, very important. So Miss Lauren Fay, I can't thank you enough for sharing your wisdom on this, and let me know when the C word gets a new PR firm.
I'll keep you in the loop.
I'll do another whole episode. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Spot On is supported by the Boston University Sargent College's Master of Science degree in nutrition program. Log on to bu.edu to learn more about this fabulous nutrition graduate program. Thank you for listening to Spot On. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This way you'll get every new episode every week. And by the way, leave us a nice review. And can you also like us on our Spot On Facebook page and suggest topics for future episodes? Please follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Joan Salgi Blake. And oh, by the way, can you send this episode to 5 of your friends? Do I ask a lot of you?